with us on WBR News. Larry Mueller here. Hey, it's time to talk home improvement on the show today. We kick off by talking about your spring home maintenance checklist. And a couple of experts for you today. Chad Spate back with us. He's the owner of Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison. Chad, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be here.
And with us, after a long dry spell, kind of, I think it was around 1914. about 2014, let's put it that way, that you were last with us. John Gishnock, welcome back, by the way.
Thank you, Larry. Happy to be here.
He is the owner of Form Ecology, LLC. It's an environmentally friendly landscaping firm. And as we talk with them, want to hear from you. Let us know maybe how you're dealing with water drainage issues, or maybe you want to share your own spring checklist. You ought to be making one up if you haven't already. We'll talk about that for sure. Give us a call with your home improvement questions. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. John, before we even get started, maybe it's been a while, as we said, 10 years or so. Tell us about Form Ecology LLC.
Thanks, Larry. We work primarily at the residential scale, so for homeowners all over Dane County, primarily southern Wisconsin, and provide landscape services that look good but are easier on the environment and greener tomorrow. So with a focus on native plants, rain gardens, things like no-mow, turf grass, organic lawn care, utilizing that entire tool belt to help clients get a little bit more connected to nature, have more pollinators in their yard while they get to enjoy the landscape.
Okay, so that gives folks an idea of what they could ask you about. Chad, you've been doing this with me for, what did we say, 20 years?
Yeah, this is the 20th year.
20 years.
Yeah.
And you've been working in Monona and Madison all...
Yeah, 33 years, so...
Yeah, that's obviously you've done okay because you're still in business after 33 years.
Still improving homes, so it's a great community to help homeowners keep their houses in good working order and add value by making various improvements. So,
well, this time of the year, good time to make a checklist.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many things that, it's one thing you undergo a remodeling project, which is primarily what I do for my business. But, owning a home is an ongoing opportunity. And, of course, some people refer to the money pit of a home. And one way to help avoid the money pit is to stay on top of necessary maintenance, being aware of different systems. And so there's a checklist, and you start on the outside by inspecting the roof, the siding, your doors and windows, certainly the foundation, maybe your driveway and walkways. You're just looking for problems, whether it's delaminating paint or curled shingles. Then you go to the inside, and there's some areas that we can talk about today. A lot of the mechanical systems are important to keep in good working order. The HVAC system is probably one of the most important because it's responsible for filtering our air.
Yeah.
And so, of course, changing those furnace filters, which we should be doing every 3 months, I would say, at a minimum. But the most important time of year, if you're ever going to just make it a habit to do it absolutely once a year, do it in the spring, because your air conditioning system is not going to function well if you have a dirty furnace filter. The heating season, of course, it's important to filter the air then too, but your heating system doesn't really rely on pulling in the return air the way the cooling system does, because you've got to dehumidify the air in your home during the summer months, and a dirty filter will sabotage that effort.
You know what I do? I buy a year's worth of filters.
Oh, yeah.
Every year, and the first of the month, I replace the villager.
That's great. Well, that's great. I mean, you know, I'm glad you said that, because typically it is the recommendation of the, you know, the manufacturer that you change the typical furnace filter monthly. There are some larger media that are only required to be changed sometimes twice a year.
Yeah.
But, you know, 3 months is a good rule of thumb for, you know, best practice.
And I keep the box, and I have a marking pencil down.
That's great.
Attached to the box, and I write the date.
You bet. I mean, we keep a Sharpie by our filter so that, you know, we're always marking that when we put it in. So,
and John, to you, this time of the year, what should we be looking at outside?
A few things that Chad mentioned. Gutters and downspouts are a pretty must-do inspection. Make sure they're working, they're not leaking, they haven't got bent by snow or dislodged in any way. But that's really our first round of defense against water and getting water in our basement. So, and I have already, we have as a company gotten probably 6 to 12 calls about drainage. So some conditions this winter have caused water in the basement. So gutters and downspouts, looking for low spots in the yard, addressing any erosion that may have happened. I like to do a visual check of the roof, or at least recommend that homeowners do a visual check at least from the ground. Damage to the home, rotting wood, we love to let our clients know about that on the exterior. Heaving walkways, a settling patio, should that ever happen, you know, with a lot of freeze and thaw and the type that we had this year with really cold and warmer. I did see a little bit more heaving than normal. And animal damage, too. I just left a client, Ken Loving, one of your past clients, said to say hello. But I think it was a skunk rooting around in the front yard looking for grubs already, but rooted up some pretty big lawn areas that we'll address. So,
Okay. Yeah,
I think those are kind of some of the basics that we look at every spring.
Chad Spade and John Gishnock, our guests today, as we talk home maintenance and repair, both inside and outside the house. We're doing a little checklist right now, but if you have a home improvement project or a question relating, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You know, I had a little problem, well, this is now 2 years ago, I had a few shingles that were a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a three-story house. So fortunately for me, the painters were working on the house at that time, and the one painter said, you know what, I had tried to find somebody who would come and... Roofer is pretty much, unless you're doing the whole roof, they're not going to come,
sure. At
least here, and at least the people that I talk to. So the painter did it for me.
Okay.
And it worked out fine, but that whole roof issue is... You want to be checking that roof.
Sure. And, of course, safety is of utmost importance. And there are times when the homeowner, you know, needs to call a professional or a handy person, something like that, to get up there and look at it. And Larry, I just wanted to mention, you know, a few other things that folks might want to be thinking about. And this also relates to ventilation. Our dryer vents are something that need to be cleaned regularly. A dryer vent duct should probably be cleaned twice a year, but definitely at least once a year. It's amazing. Even the most fastidious homeowner who's cleaning out that lint trap with every load of laundry, there's still going to be lint that ends up getting into that system and potentially causing a fire hazard. John mentioned this, and it relates to the confluence of ventilation systems and pest. It's not uncommon when you have a flapper that's malfunctioning or stuck open on these exterior vents, whether it be for a bathroom fan or for a dryer, that birds find that a very nice place to build a nest because there's some warmth there.
Yeah.
In fact, even get a nice breeze every now and then.
I had that exact problem. Actually, yeah. when the guys were painting the house, I ordered some cages.
Mm, yes.
That you could put over the, and they cleaned out the, they cleaned out the area, which was the one flue was full of
debris
bird nesting materials.
Yeah, right.
They got rid of that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah,
and the birds weren't happy when the cage went up, but
sure,
it's a hot spot.
There are many places for the birds to live, so
yeah, other than my house.
Right.
Jay in Two Rivers has a question. Hi, Jay.
Good morning.
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 Two questions. Do you have a particular dryer vent that you would recommend? Something reliable and. I know a lot of them have guards or screens over them. Other question is, many years ago when we had our old Timken oil furnace replaced with the modern condensing type, new intake air plenum and air plenum above the furnace were constructed, and we've been using a 2-foot by 2-foot by 4-inch thick, deeply pleated filters. And the original installer said that the filter would probably be good for a year. And we found that true, that it's not thickly coated with air, and air is flowing well. And I checked that with an amperometer on the blower. So, would you say for that much surface area that annually is good, or stick with 3 months?
No, these are great questions. Thank you. So, to address your last question first, it is true that the thicker media have a lot more surface area there to collect and filter debris, particulate matter. And so, because they have much more surface area, they will last longer. You are doing the important things by monitoring the airflow that you're getting. And as long as you're not significantly reducing the airflow, then the filter is able to do its job and the furnace is able to do its job maintaining comfort in the home and air quality. So 1 year for some of those thicker media would be appropriate. Though I would just say that if you find for whatever reason, the way you live in your home, that your filter seems to be getting much dirtier in that year, then I would look to maybe change it more often. It doesn't sound like you need to do that. To address the issue of the dryer vent, there are a variety of models out there. My least favorite kind of protection would be the 4 or 5 little plastic flappers, horizontal dampers that are, are prone to get stuck open or to fall out. And that's my least favorite. Generally, we're looking at wanting to have some sort of a metal grate or grill that's protecting that opening. And then there's another damper, typically a single a flapper just behind that grate. There's a really fancy model that kind of vents up and has a cap over the top of it. But I don't have enough experience with that model to say that it's worth investing in, but it is out there. And
what does it cost you? Some idea, roughly?
I believe that particular thing is about a $30 or $40, which is a lot more than, $8 to $10 grate. But still, those are some of your options. So,
There you go, Jay. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Talking home improvement today, both inside and outside the house, with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and John Geschnack, owner of Formicology LLC, an environmentally friendly landscaping firm. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk home remodeling inside and outside the house with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. John Geschnack, owner of Formicology LLC, a landscaping firm, environmentally friendly one, and great to have him with us as well. You can join in. If you have a question, give a call, 800-642-1234. Fred in Green Bay, we'll go to you now. Hi, Fred. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for accepting my call. I have two questions, one regarding my furnace filter and one regarding the outside air conditioner. I did what your guests recommended. When it was warming up, I started walking around my home, and I noticed that that outside unit with a big fan in it, the surrounding component of those things looked like little vents. Vertical shade vents, and they're all bent over now, and I'm wondering what would have caused that. And my second question regards my furnace filter. I have an April Air. You don't put it in I put it in vertically and not horizontally, and it's about 2 feet by 2 feet in a it's a paper filter. How often should I change those?
Yeah. So, well, how thick is that filter? Is it it's like a one inch, or is it one of the four inches?
No, it's thinner. It's like, I hate to say, a thin piece of cardboard. It's about that thickness.
Oh, really? Really thin.
Okay. I'm not sure exactly what that is. It might just be the media in the, or if you're referring to the April Air humidifier. There's a media that is sometimes in that is just, you know,
really.
You could take that out and rinse it in a work sink. And, you know, that's similar to the media that would be in a room air filter or something like that, I believe, though I'm not 100% sure on that. But to address your question about the air conditioning condenser out in the yard.
Are those vents, are they like they're blocking? You know, they're turned in such a way that they're not allowing air in or out?
I'll know better when I turn it on. I was just walking around and it looked like someone had taken something and rubbed against it and bent those little aluminum vents all over.
Right. So the way those work, they pull air in from the sides typically, and it's through those louvered openings. And typically that's a metal frame that has little louvers, and they're not designed to move. I mean, they are kind of stamped formed into place there, but allowing air to flow into the unit and then to blow out the top. And it could be that an animal, I don't know, I mean, maybe a deer or something might have come up and pressed itself into the side of it, or, you know.
It would take a lot to do that.
It would. I can't say that I've seen that, but... Yeah. I would have someone, you know, have a heating contractor come out to do an inspection and to offer an opinion on that, because my concern would be that if you do have something that's happened that's going to impede the airflow into that unit, it could very easily cause it to burn up or malfunction. And, I mean, at a minimum, it's just not going to operate efficiently. If the airflow is not able to, to work properly there.
So get that checked out, Fred. Good luck. Thank you for calling. And John, you were going to add something.
Well, I see here a little bit of information online about wind-driven damage and storm damage.
We've had plenty of wind.
Yeah, we've had some big winds. Maybe you don't see residual branches around the area, but an icicles falling on it. But a couple of other thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Fred. There you go. Thank you for calling, Paul in Menominee. We'll go to you now. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering about tankless water heater. What are the plus and minuses of that compared to gas?
Sure. Well, so a tankless water heater for our listeners it has become a more common alternative to the tank that we're used to having, where we heat up the water and store it in a tank. It's often a 50-gallon tank, sometimes smaller, sometimes larger.
In the basement,
yep. And so the downside to the tank, and the reason that tankless has become more popular, is that they're often called on-demand water heaters, because they're going to fire up and heat that water at the moment you open the hot water spigot there. So you turn it on and the water starts to flow, and typically it's going to be a unit that has anywhere from 100,000 to 140,000 BTUs. I mean, it's a massive amount of energy that is going to heat up that water instantaneously as it then flows to your tap. That is more energy efficient because you're not storing the hot water for an unknown time when it's going to be used. And what will happen is the temperature will drop in the tank and it'll fire up again to reheat the water. And that's constantly happening. And you might be out of town for a week and you're keeping a tank of hot water, or maybe you're just gone a lot for a spell and you're barely using your hot water, but you're constantly heating that tank of water. So the tankless systems are very reliable. They are a little more costly, but they save you money in not keeping that tank heated.
Do you have a lot of people living in your house, Paul?
No, just two.
All right. People have reported, if you've got a family and the daughter's taking a shower and the washing machine is on hot water and you go to the spigot, sometimes it's, I mean, back in the day at least,
right.
you might not be getting all hot water that you want. If
yeah,
there are a lot of spigots open at the same time.
And you're raising a great point, Larry. I mean, the size of that tankless system is going to be dependent on the typical use for the household. And so there can be times when, you have company and it's not going to keep up. Of course, the same could be said of the tank.
Sure.
You're either going to run out of hot water or you're going to have, less hot water or slightly cooler water coming out because you're putting too much demand on it. And that's where the good news is that some of those variables might be within your control, where, as a family, you've got your guest in town, mm-hmm. and you say, hey, look, we're not going to do laundry when our guests are planning to take their showers. So but that's a great point.
Yeah.
Paul, there you go. Household of two, I think, it'd be certainly something for you to consider. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jan in Suamico, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I got a question about a dryer somebody was talking about that vents back into the house. It doesn't vent outside. I was wondering if you have any experience or know much about this, because I was wondering how they handle all that humidity. Is there a coil in there someplace that takes... So that you don't... Go ahead.
Yeah, well, so thanks for the call. It is somewhat of a... workaround that I would generally not recommend, where I have seen people do this or recommend it online as a way to, you know, add moisture to your home during the winter months when, you know, typically if we have humidifiers and we have an older, leakier home, we might want to be adding some humidity in the home. And, you know, there are these things you can buy online that allow you to essentially dump that moisture back into your basement from your dryer. The problem with that, particularly if you have a natural gas-fired dryer, is that that vent is not simply venting moisture. It's also venting the fumes from that flame, which can have carbon monoxide in them. And so you don't want that to be spilling into your basement. You want that to be going out the sidewall of the home. And so this is just something that I would generally not recommend. But I am aware, and I have occasionally been in someone's basement and seen this contraption like over by their laundry sink. I'm like, what is that? You know, and that's what it is. They're recapturing the moisture from their vent. But I would not recommend that.
Thanks, Jan. Appreciate it. Kurt in Belleville, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you doing, Larry? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share a trick that I learned. We bought this house in Belleville a couple of years ago, and it had been vacant for quite some time.
Yeah.
And we had a pretty well-established bird nest. I guess you'd call it the S-bend in the downspout.
Oh,
and we would no sooner knock down the nest, and the birds would very industriously come back and start rebuilding. So we had this idea of tying a old CD onto a piece of thread and affixed it to the soffit above the S-bend. And the reflection really deterred the birds from coming back.
Spins and ever makes it moves around a bit. Yeah, not a bad idea, Kurt. I appreciate your call very much. You know, the whole business about birds and nesting, John Gishnock, reminds me about trees and shrubs and trimming. Could you talk a bit about that? What might you think about trimming the trees that are, you know, especially thinking of the trees and shrubs that are close to your home?
Yeah, I think most of the times we recommend keeping trees and shrubs off the home, off the gutter system, off the roof, so they're not causing damage. I mean, that's probably a first line of defense. That said, it's nice to have trees and shrubs around the house to shade the house, to soften the house, and make the house, you know, look nice and kind of one with the site. Yeah, speaking of birds, we have a couple of robins that'll be back here pretty soon on our porch. And a couple of rocks on the lights have deterred them for just a little while, but they built around the rocks and stayed there. So, and they keep us off the porch for about 2-3 months, you know. And they, that's you know, we enjoy seeing them. We enjoy watching the young grow up on the porch too. So, they like to nest in your lights. Keeping those clean, keeping them managed. Robins start building a nest. You could disassemble it to help them keep that out. So
yeah. Well, what about the whole business of trimming and you know, looking at the trees and so forth? Do you get somebody out? Do you know that's the kind of thing you do? You look at the trees and shrubs and make decisions or offer suggestions?
Yeah, absolutely. Early spring's a great time to start pruning. We prune kind of lower hanging branches on trees. Otherwise, Madison is home to some great arborists that if anything's above that 8-foot range, mm-hmm. we'll invite them over to help prune. Winter's a great time to prune trees. We don't prune our oak trees between, November and the end of April, staying away from our oak trees. But most other things you can prune when they're dormant. When it comes to shrubs, you know, there's two general groups of shrubs. We have our early blooming spring flowering shrubs, and then we have our summer flowering shrubs. And the summer flowering shrubs, you have to wait to winter or prune them the following spring. But the spring flowering shrubs, you don't have to wait, and you can prune them right after blooming. Sometimes if you prune too early, you prune the flower buds right off. So I think, and we're pruning some shrubs for some clients, some red twig dogwood, and we're doing renewal pruning so the canes that start to get up around an inch or two in diameter, they lose their red coloring. Those will be removed down to the ground to get rid of some of that old growth. Sometimes for height we prune, but in general, when we're trying to ease maintenance and reduce the burden of our biomass out on the terrace, we want to plant things that fit the space and let them grow to their natural shape.
Yeah.
You know, in a perfect world. Diseased and dead are always in vogue, pruning off just about any time of year. Planting new, there used to be we want us to reduce the canopy when we plant the things. Now it's just the dead branches when we plant. So
makes sense.
Yes.
Makes good sense. Bob in Janesville has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Good. Appreciate the show. I had some work done a couple years ago. Complicating factor is it was a family member that referred me to this fella, local guy. I'm not going to name him. But there's a number of things that they did. I did the roof, siding, windows, added two decks, and had some attic work done. And, like, the tub surround does not meet the wall, so that bead, that seal at the bottom leaks. Put a vanity in instead of a wall sink. He covered over half the old heat vent underneath, and it heats up the wall now instead of my room. There's three or four spots where the siding is loose and hanging down, and other spots where it's warped. Gutter leaks. Deck material was warped within 2 months, and he promised he was going to get it fixed and never did. And worked in the attic, and he left that an absolute mess. Put an attic fan in, you know, whole house fan, and he installed it improperly. I talked to him about a year ago, finally, and he just kept on saying, I'll be over tomorrow, and he never did, and I finally gave up. But my granddaughter came in the other day, Papa, your house is falling apart. A piece of siding was falling off. And I'm not sure what to do. I don't want to sue the guy, but I don't know how to get his attention to get him over here.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I'm sorry to hear about your predicament. And I mean, this just speaks to the importance of, you know, when we hire someone to work on our homes, it's important that they be a professional, that you reach out to past clients or all that. And I know you, I mean, Bob, I don't want to, you know, thank you for alerting listeners to this sort of a situation. We always have to be careful about who we invite into our homes to work on them. That said, I mean, I'm not sure what sort of a contract you have. I am not an attorney. But, you know, it does sound like there are some issues here. And I would say that I would, you know, consider reaching out to an attorney for some advice on this. And obviously, things like the contract that you had will be important. And that's why it's important to have things in writing. And
yeah.
You know, we do have rules in the state of Wisconsin, so.
Sometimes it helps. I have folks from the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection on the line on as guests. And oftentimes people will call them, and sometimes they will intervene on behalf. What they'll do is, you know, get your information. You can get it over the phone. There's an 800 number, which escapes me off the top of my head. I can't think of what it is. But anyway, you could call that number, talk to the person, and they, you may file a complaint with the person. And sometimes, well, I know they've often had very good success when they've made contacts.
Yep, that's great advice, Larry. I mean, there's no cost involved in filing a complaint through the Department of, I believe it's through the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Protection. And so.
And Lee Rayburn's come up with a phone number. So it's 800-422-7128. That's 1-800-422-7128. 1-800-422-7128. So
great.
There you go, Bob. I wish you well. And they will have some advice if things aren't turning out the way you want, mm-hmm. for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you can join in. Here's a different number for you, 1-800-642-1234. Have a question? You need some home repair information? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And speaking of emails, we got a bunch of them. Judy in Spring Grain emailed us. They have vinyl windows on their three-season porch room with screens on the outside, which are attached to the outside frames. Can the screens be removed to clean the vinyl and then put back on?
Well, probably, but I mean, every product like that has a unique way of being assembled, and so it's hard to know without seeing it. Sometimes things are a little more difficult to disassemble. Some windows are designed to tilt in or to be able to remove the actual sashes for the cleaning of the sashes. And this is something that I didn't have on my list, but, you know, window cleaning is definitely something that we do from time to time. And if you cannot open up where there are storms and screens to gain access, and you do have to figure out how to get to the outside of that glass. But a modern window will typically tilt or dissemble in a way to allow you to have access. So I would look into that.
A friend of mine came over last spring and washed my windows for me as a kind of a gift.
That's nice.
Birthday gift. And whoa, what a difference.
Oh, how nice.
It made a big difference. And when it comes to vinyl, another thing that came up, somebody was wondering about washing the outside and washing the vinyl. Is power washing a good idea?
Great question. So power washing is something that we have to be careful, how much force we are spraying onto different sorts of materials. And so, vinyl can be damaged by a high pressure sprayer. So I don't have the specs to recommend on that, but I would say that, we definitely have to be thoughtful about what we're power washing.
Susan in Sturgeon Bay emailed us. They have recently divided and sold off part of their property, so they will have nearby neighbors. They would like to establish a property line privacy border. The requirements are easy care, slow spreading, deer resistant, and 6 to 12 feet tall. So, John, what do you think?
That's a good question. I would ask if the screening needs to be year-long or if it could be seasonal. If you're not in the backyard or looking at that particular direction that you want privacy from, you could use more deciduous planting, so trees and shrubs that lose their leaves versus an evergreen. If we determine you want screening all year, you use your outdoor space, no matter what time of year, you can see your neighbor's blue car practically in your backyard, that's when you'd want to go to an evergreen screen. The go-to is arborvitae for full sun situations, small backyards. So arborvitae are nice because they go 2 to 3 times taller and not as wide. So they don't take up a lot of space in a yard. And there's probably 5 to 7 different arborvitae with different heights and widths that can fit a space. You can consider some fencing, decorative fencing panels in combination with arborvitae and planting and have a more dappled look if you want to interject some architecture into that run. And in terms of plantings in that scale and height that are deciduous or leaf droppers, the service berries are just wonderful, vase-shaped, 12-foot tall, flowering small, large shrubs, nanny berry viburnums. There are dogwoods. So there are a host of great, low-maintenance, non-suckering trees and shrubs that will provide you the privacy and also be great habitat for pollinators and birds.
All right. Good response there. Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, John Gishnock, owner of Formicology LLC, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking home improvement today with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, a Monona and Madison, John Gishnock, owner of Formicology LLC, an environmentally friendly landscaping firm. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And let's take a call from Paul in Manitowoc. Hi, Paul.
Hello. We are fixing up our house that we just bought. It was built in 1937, and I think parts of it were rewired about, maybe 2000. I discovered that the upstairs bedroom is wired with 12-gauge wire, 20-amp circuit breakers, but they only use 15-amp outlets. And, isn't that, illegal?
You're in Manitowoc. Yeah. I'm not sure what they do in Manitowoc, but yeah. Would that be illegal in Madison, Chad?
So, I hesitate to try to give expert advice on electrical wiring just because we always bring in one of our trusted electricians to really lead the conversation. But they're definitely. Having a higher gauge wire is never a problem. It's when you're getting into the lower gauge wires that do not have the capacity for the load. So I'm not sure the 12-gauge wire is a problem. But it all comes down to what is required for a given circuit. And I would have an electrician come and inspect it. And, homeowners do things to their homes, and I suspect that a professional was not involved in these changes. And unfortunately, now it, as the homeowner, you're having to deal with that.
Yeah. So. Maybe get an electrician in to take a look. And
it could be that. Yeah, some of that, though, might be okay. I mean, I don't want to tell you that you're fine.
Okay, there you go, Paul. Thank you for calling. Again, you can join us, 800-642-1234. Irene in Green Bay emailed us. They have a 30-year-old home, and for a number of reasons, they want to replace their windows. Will replacing the windows prevent frost buildup on the storm windows in winter? This usually happens on the second floor windows.
So this is a great question, and thank you for that. So the irony, sometimes what we would expect as an outcome is not, in fact, what happens, the laws of physics being what they are. And so when you put a better performing window up in your home, what you are doing is the air now that's on the exterior side of that high-performance window, or just let's just say it's a better window than what you currently have, that air is going to be colder than the air that's probably out there now with your current windows. And colder air is going to, if moisture escapes into it, is going to mean that your storm window is colder. And a cold piece of glass, if it reaches the dew point, is going to have condensation. So typically, the reason you don't see storm windows on a modern home with newer windows is that it's almost inevitable that you're going to have condensation on a storm window that's on the exterior of the house. And that's why when we're looking at making energy improvements to a newer home, we often put the storm window on the inside. Does that make sense?
That makes it makes very good sense.
Okay. So, that's probably what you're either going to get rid of your storms, or you're going to, you know, have to deal with the condensation.
Patty emailed us. Patty's condo has a Champion electrical panel that has a recall, and she's wondering if you could give an estimate on what that will cost, and if the condo has aluminum wiring, what that would cost to replace.
Mm. Well, you know, there again, I mean, it's going to require bringing in an electrician to really assess the situation. And these are two separate issues. I mean, on the one hand, you've got a electrical panel that needs to be replaced because of the recall. And that probably will be able to happen with some, a little bit of funding possibly as part of that recall. So that's a good thing. But the aluminum wiring, I mean, that's something that... only certain electricians even want to touch that. That's how sticky that is. You know, some folks just are not willing to get involved, but it can be resolved. But it, there again, you've got to worry about where the different metals are in contact and can cause all sorts of problems. So,
John from the UP of Michigan with us next. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. So you had a question from a homeowner that had some 12 wire with 15 amp receptacles on that circuit, and that is a perfectly fine installation as long as there's more than one receptacle on that circuit. If it's a individual circuit with an individual receptacle, then it has to be a 20 amp circuit.
Okay, and you're an electrical contractor, John.
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
Thanks for that.
John, thank you very much for calling. Good Appreciate stuff. Your call. That often happens on the program and over a variety of topics.
Absolutely.
Somebody will call in with some help. Mark from Scandinavia emailed us to save money on water heaters. They have a shutoff switch installed in a convenient place. And if they're not taking a shower, they keep it off, and the heater is never on when they're gone from the home. So they just turn it off when they go. Go on vacation, flip the switch, come back.
Perfectly reasonable. As long as you don't have issues with a pilot light and things like that, then, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Chuck in Shatek, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, this is Chuck in Shatek. I'm a retired electrical inspector and credentialed in the state of Wisconsin. And the thing with the 15-amp receptacle is if you look at the way the receptacle is made, you can only put a 15-amp plug into it. Whereas the 20-amp plug, it's got one ear on the plug at a right angle to the other ear, which is why a 20-amp receptacle has that T-shaped on the one. The hot lead,
right?
Okay.
Oh, that's a great.
You can put 15 amp receptacles on 20 amp wires and on 20 amp circuits because you can only get a 15 amp plug into a 15 amp receptacle. And as far as I know, there's no limit. Yeah, most of the time they just put one and they put a 20 amp on there because it might be for a sump pump or whatever. But I don't know that is code. You know, that you put a 15-amp receptacle on the end of a 20-amp circuit, and it's perfectly right because of the way the receptacle's made, and you can't get a 20-amp plug into a 15-amp receptacle. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does
indeed.
Yeah.
That's a good way to have them designed, I guess.
Yeah,
they were thinking ahead
yes.
on that one. Somebody smarter than I am was. Chuck, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Our guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, a Monona and Madison, John Gishnock, owner of Form Ecology, LLC, an environmentally friendly landscaping firm. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mingler. Great to have you with us here on WPR News, taking a look at home renovation and repair with our guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, and with him, John Gishnock, owner of Form Ecology LLC, an environmentally friendly landscaping firm. Great to have both of them with us. Questions for them, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Pat emailed us, currently there's Riverstone mulch on top of landscape fabric under their deck. The deck is about 4 feet off the ground. It's about 20 years old. Pat's wondering, can she replace wood mulch over the stones, or does Pat have to rip out the existing fabric and stones first? John Gishnock, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Larry. A couple of things come to mind. You know, maybe just what the overall goal is. If they want to see mulch underneath there instead of river gravel. The nice thing about river gravel on weed fabric is, or weed barrier, is it is, since much won't grow under a deck, it's nice to have the stone and weed fabric there. It gives you a little texture, a little color. And then on the weed barrier, the expectation is you'd never have anything growing up underneath your deck. So that's at least the purpose for what Pat has now. Assuming, you know, wanting to go to mulch is just because of maybe aesthetics, like the look of mulch under the deck. But there's other ways to screen your view under the deck too, if that deck is too high off the ground and you see underneath it too much. Now, to answer the question, if you had budget and time, I would say removing at least a bulk of the gravel would be nice. It'll make covering that river gravel easier when it's there. In a perfect world, maybe the weed fabric would be removed too, because that's probably pretty beat up, not working as well as it is now. And there are heavier duty weed fabrics that you could put down. So quick and fast, if you put 4 or 5 inches of mulch down, you'll cover the river gravel. You know, and it might feel a little weird as a professional kind of covering over, you know, a mess instead of taking out the mess and putting a new treatment back in. But, you know, I think time and budget, if you just wanted to get the mulch, you could put down more than the standard 3 and probably cover the stone. And I plan on replacing it every couple of years because mulch breaks down.
Yeah. Yep. There you go. Tom in Fish Creek has a question. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I have a heat pump that we had installed probably last July of 2024. And it works. It's set for 35 degrees, but we have to do it manually. It doesn't appear to be shifting from propane to heat. And the air conditioning is not warm months are not a problem. We just turn it on. But right. In the winter, this is our first winter with the heat pump, and we have used a 500-gallon tank of propane so far. So I'm wondering, is there a problem? We had the thermostat redone. We had an Ecobee thermostat, and now we have a Honeywell thermostat. And is it supposed to shift over on its own?
Okay, well, so I am not a HVAC technician, but I will say that, you know, we have heat pumps installed on many of our clients' homes, and this has become an increasingly reliable technology to gain considerable efficiency in most circumstances for the building occupant. So I would call the contractor that installed this, and I presume that you're working with this company, that you had it professionally installed, and that...
Right. He's here. He comes, like, every week.
Are they perplexed? Yeah. Are they trying... They feel like there's a problem that they haven't figured out how to solve yet, or...?
Yeah, I think so. And okay. I have two... I'll repeat one question. It's supposed to isn't it supposed to shift over from propane heat pump automatically? That's one question. The other question is, do I have to have, which I do not have, but do I have to have internet service in order to make this thing work?
Well, so to the first question, I do believe that it is supposed to change over automatically. And for our listeners, I mean, this is often referred to as a dual fuel technology because a heat pump will only work down to a certain temperature when it's an air exchange heat pump. And some of them go down to 0 degrees. Some of them require a shift over to that second fuel, whether it's natural gas or propane. Or an electric coil backup, but they all require that at some temperature, somewhere between 0 and 40 degrees. And I have never encountered a system that did not make that switch when it detected that it needed to make the switch. But it also should be delivering a fairly efficient heating. And it's, and I mean, from the way you said it, I'm going to guess that you're not used to consuming 500 gallons of propane in a winter, or maybe you are. I don't know how large your home is, so.
All right. There you go, Tom. So I guess continue to work with the guy.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like there's something that seems to be wrong either with,
installation.
I mean, it could be the installation. It could be the equipment. I mean, it sounds like the contractor is trying to figure that out. But I would be persistent because at the end of the day, you've purchased something that should be delivering some payback and value for you.
There you go, Tom. Thank you for calling. Yolanda in Wausau, we go to you. Hi, Yolanda.
Hi. I've lived in my house for 32 years, and we've always had a wet basement. And I'm now in the process of getting bids to remedy that after all these years. And it looks like it possibly could cost upwards of $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that I may move in the next few years, like to downsize.
Mm-hmm.
Is this worth that level of investment this late in the game, or just hang on with the wet basement and let the next buyers down the road take care of it?
Sure. Well, so that's a great question. And so one of the things that you're going to likely have to disclose on the real estate report when you list your home for sale is whether or not you have a wet basement. And so, you know, it is something you could choose to simply disclose and roll the dice on what impact that has on the value of the home when you sell it. But as a general rule, you know, having a consistently wet basement would be something worth remedying or installing some systems that are going to reduce the negative impact of that. And I don't know what your property is worth and how you view all of this, and maybe you're going to end up living there for another, 2 to 5 years. It probably would be of value to you to invest that $10,000. That doesn't sound like an unreasonable amount of money for the typical sorts of solutions that we would employ in mitigating that. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't know if it's going to be a drain tile with a sump. The only thing that I would say is that I would consider putting in a radon mitigation system with that, because that'll keep the sump drier, and it will deal with the radon if you have radon under your home.
Yeah, all good points. I was thinking about my own home. When we moved in, I had water, a little water coming into the basement. I was surprised the heck out of me, and then I went out and I took a look at my downspouts, and I extended the pipe about 2 feet, and I haven't had any problems since. And I know, John, you do some landscaping to kind of help mitigate those sorts of problems, do you not?
We sure do. Chad Gray provided some great information there. I would say just make sure Yolanda's checking the gutters and downspouts first. That's a low-hanging fruit when it comes to repairing drainage issues. And so if those systems are working and getting water away from the foundation, that's good to hear. But sure, raising the grades or lowering the grades along a foundation of a house to help move water out away from the structure and out to the property line where most of the times where you want it to go is the general technique. And then utilizing drain pipes and underground systems when needed to further move water. And as Chad has taught me, have redundancy in our system. But in terms of would I fix that, I think homeowners, inspectors are much more savvy about water in the basement. And if you knew how many calls I get about water in the basement, it would seem like everybody in Madison does, and they all know about it. And yeah, I think the pricing is in line with what we see. And if it's done well, it would be nice to say my house doesn't leak water or I haven't seen water in my basement in a couple of years when I sold it for that cost.
Yeah.
Money well spent.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for that call. Ben in Hortonville will go to you. Hi, Ben.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've got a house that was built in the early 90s. I got a few windows, double panes, that have fogged up. I'm wondering if there's a solution, in-house maintenance where I can re-inject the argon gas or whatever is supposed to be in there to keep that the moisture out of there?
Sure. Great,
or do I have to replace
great question.
The entire window?
Yeah, unfortunately, I am not aware of any sort of thermopane patch that can be applied. I mean, basically, when those windows are manufactured, that vacuum and seal are done under very, exceptional factory conditions.
Hermetically sealed conditions.
Yes, yes. I mean, it is something that, and I'll also say that different window manufacturers have different warranties on that seal. Back in the 90s, it was probably a 10 or a 20 year warranty on that window. So unfortunately, you are past the point of it being a warranty repair. But I will say for all of our listeners that, when you do have a thermopane fail and you see that moisture inside, the first thing you should do is check and see if it's still under warranty. Because then often, I know we work a lot with a couple of different window manufacturers, they will send out free of charge an entire replacement sash to replace that or to fix that window, to make it new again. But what you're likely to have to do is to have a thermopane replaced. And some windows, you can actually do that within the sash, and then others, the entire sash is going to have to be replaced. And that's something that we'd have to look at the window to be able to tell you.
Yeah, there you go, Ben. Thank you for calling. Kit in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Kit.
Hello. Have you ever, I was looking up a whirly bird, I think it's called. They're made in Australia. That may be a brand name, but they are for taking the moisture out of a room. And when I studied it to some detail, I Googled it. They were used in Australia for taking moisture out of it to keep the room cool. Well, I was wondering, you know what these are? They look like an onion dome. They go on, they use them on barns sometimes to ventilate a barn.
Oh, you mean on the roof?
The roof vent.
Yeah, on the roof.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my question is this. Would they take moisture out of a room in the winter as well as in the summer?
Typically in the wintertime, if you have a leaky structure, the air that leaks into it, like if you're removing air from a home or from a building or room, then some air is going to have to come in for that to actually work, right? So when you dry or when you pull air into a room, if it's just haphazardly pulling in the outdoor air in the winter, that's going to be very cold air that's also going to have practically no moisture potential. So it will definitely dry out the air. And that's, in effect, what happens in an older home when we're just living in the home. You know, you have a bathroom fan, or you have a dryer vent, or a stove hood van fan that is venting, sucking air out of the house. And the makeup air is just typically the air that's leaking around windows and doors. That's very cold air in the winter, and it dries out the home. And that's why it used to be that we would install humidifiers in these homes because they got too dry. So, I mean, the answer to the question is that on the one hand, it's kind of simple physics, but it's also kind of complicated because there are all these variables. And so I'm not sure if you're going to be able to accomplish that goal with the whirly bird up there on the ceiling or on the roof. But those sorts of vents, I mean, definitely can help move air. The question, though, is what impact will it have on humidity? And that's more complicated.
Yeah. Kit, thanks a lot for calling. I was thinking about those. I had those on, and put on a house about two houses ago, I think, or maybe three houses ago. And it worked pretty well on the roof, and for what I needed, at least.
Right.
Wayne and Phillips, we'll go to you next. Hi, Wayne. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
Hey, I bought a house a few years back. The basement, a block basement. They semi-finished it quite a few years ago. I mean, guessing who knows when, but to finish off the outside walls, they just glued like open cell insulation to the wall and then glued good old-fashioned wood paneling to that. Yeah, sure looked good at the time, but now once in a while, some of that glue's letting go and stuff's falling off, and I want to redo it so it looks good again. What's your best suggestion on how to insulate? I see it done a lot of ways, but a way to insulate without, you know, possibly getting mold over the years from the blocks warming up, cooling down.
Yeah, so thanks for the call, Wayne. So the fact that open cell insulation was used is actually a good call in this sort of a environment, because in a basement, when you're down below grade, the natural physics of the home is to pull in air and moisture down at the bottom and then to expel it at the top of the structure. And so if you put in a vapor barrier into that wall assembly, you are going to trap moisture, and that's going to lead to potential problems of mold and rot and things like that. So you could simply tear out the old material and do something similar this time around. There are also additional things that you could do if you wanted. I don't know if you have a drain tile in the space, but if you wanted to put one in, it would be an ideal time to integrate some sort of a dimple board into that drain tile, and that would allow any moisture, whether it's vapor or liquid, to go down into your drain tile. And then you could actually seal things up there, having given the water someplace to go, and have a more conditioned, healthier space down in the basement. There are different types of strapping that, I mean, there are a number of approaches, but I think you're on the right path. And if you just follow those basic principles of building science so that you're not trapping moisture or you're giving it a place to go, then you can definitely create a more comfortable space.
Yeah. Wayne, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Vern.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a note to the electricians. Now, you think 40, 50 years ago, they used thermoset plastics. They were heat resistant up to like 460 degrees. Now they use a thermoplastics. They melt. They're not as heat resistant as the old ones were. So they're made, out of thermoset plastics.
Yeah.
Is Vern right on that?
Well, I mean, they're definitely, you know, we do have to be careful with following the code and, you know, using the right materials. And there are definitely some things that we use now that are, you know, less expensive. And, you know, you can have failures if things aren't done right. So. Mm-hmm.
And, John, you mentioned sloping away from the house to make sure that the water goes away from the house. What's the amount? I know as houses, they settle a bit over time, and so you're almost putting the water toward the house. What's the slope that you need to have for that?
Yeah, you bet. Basically, it's 2%, quarter inch per foot. Would be the minimum of moving water on lawn. I believe code wants us to be about 6 inches below the siding treatment, the exterior finish on a home. With people with water issues where we got to lower the grade, that's pretty tough, you know, to be a full 6 inches. But you want to be underneath the siding so, you know, water isn't compromising your siding. You do want to compact the soil against the house. But we're often very lucky if we can get that quarter inch per foot or 2% slope, which is about 2 feet every 100 feet of run. And then just to answer your question about settling, you bet any new remodeling or an addition or a new home can settle up to a couple of years around the foundation of a home. So the expectation would be to maybe plan to fill that back in. I know some professionals don't like to build patios in those new home construction for that past couple of feet. But it is definitely something to be aware of. And that does become a reason why you have water in your home because of that settling. So,
and one final thing, Katarina wonders, how do you find a qualified roofer?
Well, I would always recommend a couple of professional associations. One is the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, NARI. You can go to NARI.org and look in your area for roofers. There's also the Better Building or Better Business Bureau. Certainly look at online reviews and talk to past clients when you're hiring a roofer.
Yeah. And just back to the consumer protection, Ag Trade and Consumer Protection, you can get a list of complaints that men may have been filed against
roofers
or anybody else that is involved in consumer type issues.
Yep.
And on that note, we are out of time. Chad, John, thank you both very much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Larry.
Same here. Thank you. It always goes so fast.
Yeah, we'll look forward to another visit. Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Design Build of Madison and Monona. John Gishnock is owner of Farm Ecology, LLC, an environmentally friendly landscaping firm. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Chad's Design Build is one of WPR's many business sponsors. So we thank him for that as well. Coming up, we're going to take a look at pools and hot tubs. You want one for your home, or maybe you have one and you have a problem with it? You can join in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Well, we'll talk about pools and hot tubs now. Having your own pool or hot tub at home, it can provide a little backyard escape. But before you jump in, there's a lot to consider. Do you want an in-ground or maybe above-ground pool? How much maintenance will a hot tub require? Well, we have somebody who can answer those questions and probably a whole lot more. We're talking today with Kim Steffenhagen. He's general sales manager at Patio Pleasures in Sun Prairie in Madison. Just to mention as well, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll be talking more about water. As a matter of fact, you'll hear about the best ways to water your plants, how to install pleasant water features in your garden. But first, tell us why maybe you have a pool, you have a hot tub. Tell us why you love them, or maybe you got an issue with them. Maybe you could share what you think others should know before considering constructing of a pool or a hot tub. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Kim Stefanagan, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
To begin, let's just tell us a little bit more about what Patio Pleasures does.
Patio Pleasures is a pool, hot tub, sauna, furniture retailer who services all of those items, installs all of those items, and help people live better lives. You know, we're all about wellness, inspiring the endless weekend, and, you know, kind of bringing vacation to your backyard.
Yeah, yeah. And I assume there's many variations in sizes and shapes of pools and tubs that you might, and hot tubs that you might offer.
Absolutely. You know, with all the different categories, like for instance, like say, for instance, pools.
Yeah.
You've got above ground pools. In that category, you have round pools, you have oval pools. You know, some manufacturers even make different, you know, rectangular pools. We really specialize in, you know, for the above ground market and especially in our area, you know, kind of making it as turnkey as we possibly can. So like in ground pools, you're going to have many different styles of pools. You can have a vinyl liner pool, which is in ground. You can have a fiberglass pool. The fiberglass pool we really specialize in. There's a new category pool too called a plunge pool, which is really, really taken on a lot of traction in the last 5 years. And, you know, some people go down to Florida and that's kind of where the concept came from. But in our area, you know, it's during the summer, of course. So those are really small pools, can be as small as 8x16 or as big as 12x24. But good for soaking in instead of, you know, necessarily swimming laps.
So kind of like a hot tub in the summer.
Kind of like that. It's like it's like you can cool off. It's like air conditioning. You know, for the pool, you know, so a lot of people love that.
Yeah, and you can set up some nice arrangements around it and kind of a nice place to, even if you're not jumping in,
right?
Kind of a nice place to just sit and relax and look at the water and have yourself a good time.
A lot of people go on vacation and sit by the pool in the chaise lounge, you know, and maybe some of the families jumping in the pool, but not everybody. It's a great place to gather and hang out.
Wondering about, I'm sure you're involved in this, specializations of a pool or a hot tub. And I'm thinking about things like a little waterfall, maybe, or a diving board, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, depending on, you know, the pool, and they have to meet certain safety requirements. You know, we do have pools where they work with a diving board. You just have to have the right depth on the deep end. A lot of people love to get slides. And we do different slides that slide into the pool. You know, that's all in the planning stages, getting all the plumbing and proper. And, you know, we've done different things like fire features in corners of pools. You know, that water kind of trickles over and you can have a fire pit coming out of the corner called fire bowls. You know, there's all these different types of fun stuff that you can do.
Oh, yeah. That
bubblers
like
coming out of the shallow end, and you've got tanning ledges, so it's only like 8 inches deep.
So lots of different things that can go on with that. And You mentioned you like the fiberglass when it comes to the pool. Why do you more often use fiberglass as opposed to some of those other types?
Sure. The fiberglass tends to be the lowest maintenance. Because it doesn't have a porous surface, it's easier to maintain that surface. So, you know, different things that, you know, like a vinyl liner, sometimes you can deal with a little bit more algae issues and things like that over the life of the pool, nothing you can't, you know, deal with. But you've got, so that's a big benefit. The other big benefit with that fiberglass pool is it comes precast in one shape, and they can do a lot of unique shapes and features. So like the tanning ledge I mentioned, the pool can come with a pre-built shelf for a tanning ledge. That could be, you know, 8 feet wide or even, you know, a little bit wider. And then it's a preformed bottom. So you can, you know, go gradually from one level to a 6.5 foot deep end. The other big, really nice thing about it is the installation tends to be a little bit faster. So you still go through all the stages of building an in-grown pool, but literally there's water getting installed in it by day one, day two. Not ready to swim necessarily, but it just feels like the process moves quicker.
And let's talk some more about the hot tubs and the different models of hot tubs. Maybe you can talk about the kinds of ones that you have too.
Yeah. So for hot tubs in Wisconsin, most of them are all be considered portable hot tubs. It's pretty rare that you have an in-ground hot tub in Wisconsin unless it's at a commercial environment. So most of them are all going to be portable. And what that means is that, you know, you can put them on a concrete slab, right? They come in all different shapes and sizes, from a, you know, 2 to 3 person all the way up to like a 8 to 10 person hot tub, or even a swim spa. That's another category where you can swim against the current. You know, so you've got all those different shapes, sizes, and everybody's backyard is unique. And, you know, everybody's vision is unique. And so a lot of times, you know, we're just designing the project. And we're finding the right sized hot tub to fit their space, and helping design around it. Because, you know, you don't want it to just look like a box of water, right? You want it to look and flow with your landscape and make sure that the steps are in the right spot and the cover opens off. And we use what's called the cover lifter to make it easy to open the hot tub so one person can do it and it's not a chore. So you got all those different variations when it comes to sizes. And we specialize in two manufacturers specifically. We specialize in Bullfrog Spas. It's a manufacturer we partner with that has, you know, all the way from a traditional spa all the way up to a swim spa. But they specialize in more advanced technology in the jetting. The beauty of that particular manufacturer is you can pick your seats. Normally in a hot tub, you sit where you sit because it's the most comfortable based on your height. And with that manufacturer, you actually get to put the seat you like to use where you sit. It's very unique. It's the only one in the industry like that. And people love it.
Yeah. It sounds great. I'm wondering, you know, my next door neighbor has a hot tub. They use it in the wintertime. And I've often wondered about and I haven't asked him about it, but insulation. I mean, if you're going to run a hot tub in the winter and it's outside, you got to have that thing insulated pretty darn good, I'm thinking.
You are 100% correct. And that is a different... There's all different categories of hot tubs. Usually, like the kind that we carry, we're on more on the premium side. So we're going to have the most energy efficient hot tubs pretty much on the planet, I always like to say. So there is no more space to put insulation. Some manufacturers cut costs there. where they'll just do like a wrap around the outside, or they'll do just the bare minimum, right? But everything we do is almost completely insulated. And they make them in a way that, you know, 10 years down the road, if you ever need to access something, you can access it, which is the downside to insulating as good as you can, is you have to be able to make it so you can access it. Like if you ever needed to get at the far corner of that hot tub or something like that. So that's the brands that we partner with make that process very, very simple as well. So you don't have the negative side effect of a hot tub that's well insulated for Wisconsin weather.
Kim Steffenhagen, our guest today, general sales manager at Patio Pleasures in Sun Prairie, talking with him about pools and hot tubs. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking pools and hot tubs now with our guest, Kim Steffenhagen, general sales manager for Patio Pleasures in Sun Prairie in Madison. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join us, email to talk@WPR.org or give a call, 1-800-642-1234. James in Waukesha emailed us. You were talking about in-ground. They have an old in-ground hot tub built into the floor of their basement, that they want to remove. The power is to it is shut off on the circuit breaker board, but they do not know if the water supply is active. What should they know about do for removing this hot tub?
Sure, absolutely. So typically, if it's an in-ground spa, built into a basement or really any room, typically the equipment that runs that unit is going to be in another space. Most hot tubs are portable. Even the ones that are built into the ground don't typically have a water source running to them. They typically are filled with a garden hose, even the in-ground units. So I would verify that, locate where your equipment's located. That's really the only plumbing that's going to be going from the unit itself to and from that circulates and filters and cleans the water. So in most cases, that's not typically an issue. And if it's indoors and, you got to try to pull it out of the ground, and if you don't have a door big enough, then you take a Sawzall and have somebody make sure they're properly, cover their face properly with a mask, to make sure you don't get fiberglass in your lungs and all that good stuff, and cut it up into pieces and get it out, and then do whatever you got to do to fill the hole.
There you go. Jan in Kenosha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have been seeing on TV on these home shows, they're now showing making pools out of shipping containers. Is that a fad, or is it a good thing, or is it a good thing or a bad thing? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Jan. Pools out of shipping containers, good or bad?
You know, I've seen it in a lot of trade magazines. I haven't seen it in Wisconsin yet. They can be pretty contemporary looking the way they build them. As long as you've got a way to remove the water, filter it, clean it, and have the water shoot back in and get proper filtration, you can pretty much use any vessel theoretically to make a pool. So I've seen them done different ways where they design specific liners for those devices, a shipping container, and it's just a unique way. They're building even houses out of those now, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of different things you can do to hold water.
I'd want to know what was being shipped in the shipping containers before.
Yeah.
Are they shipping chemicals or whatever would make a difference in my mind anyway.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Jan, there you go. Megan in Oliva. We'll go to you now. Hi, Megan.
Hey, I have a question about what I think is a hot tub water heater. We bought a house a few years ago, and I think it housed a hot tub at one point in the backyard. There's a power source near the back deck area that I think was used for the hot tub. And then I think there's a, it looks like maybe an instant hot water heater in their basement. The brand is Noritz, N-O-R-I-T-Z. And I'm just wondering how I would go about seeing if that setup still works. Is that a plumber? Is that HVAC? Is that a pool company? Thanks.
All right.
That one, I would almost refer to a plumber first to see if they can diagnose, you know, if there's not a vessel or body water or lines that go to it and from it. An instant hot water heater, in our industry, there's not really much of that out there. It's all either like heat pumps or gas pumps or propane or heaters, I should say. So that one I would definitely diagnose with a plumber.
All right. There you go, Megan. Thank you for calling. Pete in Wautoma, what's on your mind?
I am thinking about installing an infinity type pool. I haven't really looked into it much, but I have a house on a hillside. It's a walkout basement, but there's no plumbing drains in the basement. The well pump and so forth is down there. Two questions. One, when I drain it, does it have to be drained into the septic system? And then I would have to do some sort of lift pump. And number two, how would this affect humidity in the house? If I have this in the house, in the basement, am I going to have some sort of dehumidification unit there and perhaps even an enclosed room to control the humidity? I'll take the answer off air. Thank you.
Okay. All good questions, I believe.
As far as like a infinity pool, you said it was on a hill at first, so it made me think outside, and then you mentioned inside.
Yeah. Wants to put it in his basement, and it's sort of a...
like a...
the basement is exposed on the on one end from the sound of it.
Okay. So any pool that's put indoors definitely needs a way to control the humidity, for sure. 100% yes. And in a lot of people that build pools indoors do kind of separate it from the house a little bit to be able to control the moisture and keep it from spreading throughout the house. And then as far as draining the pool, there's different codes around that from different municipalities even on where the water would drain to. Typically, the only reason you need to drain water is going to be if you were backwashing a filter or cleaning something like that. So, you know, in most cases, it's wasted outdoors. But, you know, if it's indoors and you need to plumb it in line and it needed to be wasted into a septic system, then I would definitely consult a septic expert for that part of it. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Kim, calling. Jack emailed us. They have an older soft tub 140 that has heating issues. Can you service this hot tub?
You know, it's not a manufacturer, for instance, that say, Patio Pleasure services, but sometimes there's different independents that offer service for, say, a soft tub. The one piece of advice I give you right away is just remove your filter, make sure there's no debris in the hot tub that could get sucked into your pump, and temporarily run it and see if it heats. A lot of times, 70% of the time, it can be literally just a filter clogged that stops it from heating. So I'd always start with the obvious things first. Secondly, you know, it can be just the heater. I'm not as 100% familiar. Soft Tub's not a brand I've ever carried, you know, but I would reach out to them directly and say, do you have a service technician for our area? And that way you can get right to who they recommend. You know, there's usually a warranty service provider for manufacturers that aren't care that, you know, brick and mortar dealers.
Jim wonders, what kind of changes might you need to make to your home's electrical panel before you get a hot tub?
So that's a great question. With a hot tub, in most portable hot tubs, you're going to want to do 220 40 amp or 50 amp service, up to 60 amp service. And then some manufacturers, one of them that we have has a 30 and a 20 breaker. So really, before the service gets installed, it's actually ideal to pick out the hot tub so the right service that is needed for the hot tub gets installed. But that is a great planning question. And the one other tip that I want to give anyone that has electrical done ahead of time is there's different codes on where that electrical GFCI subpanel can be installed. And some electricians, even though they're in the trade and that's their specialty, they think, okay, hot tub, it's going to go there. And they put it too close to where the hot tub's going to go, not thinking about the hot tub in the space they have planned for the hot tub, because that needs to be a minimum space distance. In most cases, it's 5 feet minimum away from that subpanel. So just plan that out before electrical gets installed so you don't have to redo something or technically break code.
Very, very good points. What are the daily upkeep requirements for a pool or a hot tub?
So the biggest thing when you're taking care of pool or spa water is, number one, bring a sample to, we do a lot of water testing for people.
Okay.
Bring a sample of the water in, and we can help guide the process, right? Getting the water balanced properly. That's where it starts kind of getting to do a different foreign language for people.
Yeah.
And we know how to speak that language and try to make it easy to understand, because you have to balance the pH, balance the alkalinity, balance the calcium of the water. And that's the first step in maintaining any body of water for a pool or a spa, right? And then there's the sanitation of the water. And there's a lot of different ways to get to the finish line when it comes to that. With hot tubs, we have a lot of different devices that are on them that make the water care much, much easier. The goal is always going to be, what can we do to make this as easy as possible?
Yeah.
Because that's the number one concern that folks have when it comes to owning a body of water, whether it be a pool or a hot tub. So the key up there is making sure you're partnered with a reputable person and or company that can help guide that process to make that as easy as possible to take care of. So it's just simply sanitizing, filtering, and balancing the water. So that's going to be the main steps to caring for a pool or a spa.
Yeah. And, of course, here in Wisconsin, you got to do you have to get all the water out of a pool when it comes, winter is approaching, sort of thing?
For the kind that we do, actually, we drain it to a certain level based on the pool. Some we don't at all. But they get special devices installed called gizmos, and they actually winterize pools. But they all require their own special, unique characteristic. We have an amazing service team that literally closes hundreds and hundreds of pools and opens hundreds and hundreds of pools. The big key is it's got to be done right per the pool. Otherwise, you've got major nightmare when it comes to opening it.
Yeah, so. I like that. I like that a lot. I always had a service at our lake home that came and put our pier in and took it out.
Right.
And after I tried it myself and did it myself a year or two, I decided that, why am I doing this? It was a whole lot more pleasant when you have a service like what you're talking about with the pools or the hot tubs, especially
absolutely.
The pools.
Absolutely.
Kim, it has been a pleasure. I guess we have to do this again. Boy, the time flew by. Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to another visit. Thanks, Kim.
Sounds great. Thank you, Larry.
Kim Stefanhagen, General Sales Manager at Patio Pleasures in Sun Prairie and Madison. They work both Madison and Sun Prairie. Great to have them with us today to talk pools and hot tubs. A lot of fun. And thank you for joining us today for this program. Garden Talk will be coming up tomorrow. We'll talk more about water on Garden Talk. But for now, our producers, thank you very much, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow for Garden Talk. But in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.